With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon podcast. On the show this week, we will be discussing David Lowry's ghost story, as well as hearing from the writer-director David Lowry himself. And not only that, but we also have an extra special guest this week in the form of filmmaker and film critic Charlie Lyne, who drops in to talk to us as well. I'm Sam Howlett, and this week I'm joined by two co-hosts, Irena Musumeci.
Hello.
Hello. And Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get into the main show, what have you guys been watching?
Yeah, I could go first. So this week I watched a documentary called Blank City, which is, well, the internet can't quite make its mind up on when this was made. It's any time between 2009 and 2011, but let's go with 2010. Happy medium. It's a documentary about the DIY independent filmmaking scene in New York in the late 70s, the No Wave movement, which birthed people like Jim Jarmusch, most famously. His first film, Permanent Vacation, is a kind of one of the main films in that movement. It's about all the artists, the collectives, the musicians and the filmmakers who hung around places like CBGB's and Max's Kansas City and made films on their own dollar, with borrowed or stolen equipment, and really had it captured a moment for a few years where they were doing some very avant-garde things, really making their own style of filmmaking. And then it morphed into cinema transgression, people like Nick Zedd and Richard Kern, and then they all fell out with each other and it died a death. But it was quite an exciting little moment, and a few of those filmmakers, Jim Jarmusch being the lead one, carried on.
Right, cool. Irena, how about yourself? What have you been up to? What have you been watching?
So, very unusually for me, I've been on a holiday, and a real holiday, not a film industry holiday where you end up at a film festival and you stick yourself into a cinema every day. So I've not actually been watching very much, but I have been reading a really cool trilogy of books written by Jeff Vandermeer, who's an American sort of sci-fi writer who specializes in a genre called the New Weird. And it's very much kind of nature writing meets H.P. Lovecraft. So the reason I'm mentioning it is because the trilogy has just been adapted by Alex Garland into a film, which will be released, I think, around February, March next year. And the first chapter is called Annihilation. And basically, he's cast Natalie Portman as the main character, who plays this kind of biologist who goes into an expedition into a space called Area X, presumably off the coast of Florida. And this is an area where some kind of event has happened, which is very complicated to unpack and explain without major spoilers. Okay. But essentially a place where nature has kind of taken over from man and has developed into this kind of semi-alien form of life, and everyone who walks into it is forever changed. The film will star Oscar Isaac as well. I'm very excited about this particular piece of casting. I think he'll do great in a kind of slightly smaller but no less important role. So very much excited about that. And it was really nice to rest my eyes for a little bit.
Will this be Garland's first film since Ex Machina?
I think so, yeah, which is also very exciting because Ex Machina was fantastic.
Yeah, great film.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I saw a very strange film on Netflix called Coherence.
Okay.
Which is incredibly low-key. It's pretty much all set in one house. It has about 8 people in it. And it's about this sort of group of couples that meet up for like a dinner party while a comet passes over Earth. And then strange stuff begins to happen, like stuff with time, stuff with kind of almost parallel dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all done on an incredibly low budget. And all most of it is, in fact, in one room. And I just thought this is the kind of thing that could only get an audience through Netflix these days, because it's so small, it's so hard to explain it to people without spoiling it, it's got no stars. But yeah, I was really impressed by it, about how low-key it was and how it got these big sci-fi ideas out there through that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I highly recommend Coherence. And it had Nicholas Brendon, who you may remember as Xander from Buffy.
Oh.
And I actually haven't seen him.
Dates us a bit.
Yeah. I haven't seen him in anything for ages, so that was a nice surprise.
Oh, so this is the week of weird, strange and weird, all three of us.
Right, so as I mentioned earlier, our film of the week this week is A Ghost Story, which follows the ghost of a recently deceased man who remains in the house he shared with his wife after his death. It's David Lowery's first film since his big-budget Disney movie Pete's Dragon, and it reunites him with Casey Affleck as the ghost of the title and Rooney Mara as his wife. The film, which was largely shot in secret, premiered at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival, where it became one of the most talked about films at the festival, partly because it chooses to silence its lead actor and hide him under a sheet for the majority of the film, partly because of its unusual aspect ratio and because of a long scene involving chocolate pie. So before we discuss it, here's Jake Cunningham talking to the film's writer and director, David Lowery.
Okay, so we are delighted to welcome David Lowery, director of A Ghost Story, onto the Curzon Film Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, the film that we're talking about today, all around London, in the magazines, in the tube, across the country, people are all being confronted by this image of a ghost in a white sheet. Now, was that image and shape the starting point of this film for you?
It was indeed. That image actually predates the movie. I've been wanting to make a movie with a ghost in a bedsheet for a very long time and just waiting for the right movie to utilize it. So this was that movie, but it's an image that has been on my mind for a while.
Okay, and was it a Halloween outfit for you that kind of just distorted and turned into something that could be a bit more than just a ghost in a sheet?
Exactly. I love the idea of taking this image, which is universally understood to represent a ghost, and letting it actually be a ghost. We usually there's usually like an intermediary interpretation, which is you look at it and think, oh, that's someone dressed up as a ghost. And if you remove the dressed up as from that, you know, understanding, you're left with a really interesting representation of an actual phantom and of an actual spirit of someone who has, you know, left their life behind. And I really wanted to see if we could imbue this Halloween costume with something that felt truly supernatural.
And I think that's it. It's more supernatural than anything else, because it made me think, like, directors like Guillermo del Toro will take a ghost and repurpose it and reimagine it and reverse the horror onto the human characters. And it's more the traditional horror figure that we might identify with in something like Pan's Labyrinth or Devil's Backbone. But it still retains in the horror genre. Now here, we're operating with a horror character, but completely outside of its genre. Was that a big part of the appeal for you?
Yeah, I mean, I love the horror genre. It's probably my favorite genre, and I love going to the movies and getting scared. And I love the works of Guillermo del Toro. I love how he subverts the genre while still participating in it. And I wanted to participate in it as well, but I knew that this movie wasn't a horror film. I wanted to use some of the tropes of horror films and some of the language of horror films, but I wanted to use them for a film that definitely wasn't scary and definitely wasn't a horror film. I've said horror film far too many times in the past sentence, so forgive me for that. But I definitely wanted this to be, you know, a provocative movie, but I knew it wasn't going to be scary. I knew it was going to be thoughtful and contemplative and hopefully emotional and strange and unusual, but I knew that, you know, there's no one for a second would ever mistake it for an actual horror film.
And so at the center of the film, we've got the ghost, Casey Affleck, his wife, Rooney Mara. And to me, the third character and almost the subject of the film is the house as well. Could you tell me how that came into it?
I mean, I love making movies about abandoned houses. This is my third one, and particularly old abandoned houses in Texas. So it's a touchstone for me, and something I keep returning to. And indeed, it is sort of the third character in the film. It's the thing our character can't let go of. And, you know, for a long time, I was debating as to whether I should call this movie A Haunted House. Like, I initially thought that would be the title of the movie. Ultimately, the ghost took precedence over the house. And that was, you know, I think the right choice to make. But definitely the house was on my mind a lot. And that was, finding the right house and finding a house that would, you know, that could change in the way that this house changes in the film was one of the most important aspects of pre-production.
And it's the film's full of a lot of kind of lovely cinephilic talking points, like, oh, it's actually a ghost story, but he's just a white sheet, or the aspect ratio and the round, and it's shot on film. So before you started shooting it, did you imagine that the aspect ratio of the film would be this talking point as well?
No, I did not think anyone would ever really have much to say about that, because I felt that the costume would overwhelm the conversation. So I'm excited that people are excited by the aspect ratio. That's really great, because I love that aspect ratio, and I'm glad that folks are picking up on it. I also knew that, you know, this is an unusual movie and it's a little bit off the beaten path, and I felt that if we, you know, from frame one presented the audience with an image that was slightly unusual, as that aspect ratio is nowadays, it would clue people into the fact that this movie is going to be a little bit off the beaten path. So I thought it would be helpful in that regard, but I didn't realize it would become a talking point, and I'm glad that it has.
Yeah, because it made me think, I wonder, when Alexander Payne was making Nebraska and wanted it to be black and white, he was forced to make a color cut as well. Was there any trouble that you had to convince people to shoot this in the way that you wanted to shoot it?
No, not at all. The only trouble was having to retrain my brain to think about images in a square instead of a rectangle. I just naturally think in widescreen, and even though I love the 1:3:3:1 aspect ratio, it took a lot of, you know, work to figure out how to use it right. It wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be.
And a big part of the film that's kind of lived on for me since watching it has been the music. You've brought Daniel Hart over from your previous projects, and in the last 12 months we've had his incredible scores for this film, for Pete's Dragon, and he's also done the music for S-Town, which I think is amazing. Do you feel like you've kind of struck gold with him as well?
Oh, 100%. Half of the reason I make movies is to give, you know, Daniel Hart an excuse to write another score, because I just want to hear more of his music. I love what he does. He grew up with my producing partner, Toby Halbrooks, and Toby introduced me to him when I needed music for my very first film, Saint Nick. And he's done every film I've made since then, and I can't imagine doing any project without him. I feel I get the movie 2/3 of the way to the finish line, and he brings it home, and I'm happy to let him do it, because what he does is absolutely amazing.
And there's a recurring song in the film, I Get Overwhelmed, with the location, cinematography, the set. Knowing that Casey Affleck's character was a musician, I kind of got it in my head that he would be kind of making War on Drugs, Bruce Springsteen-y, Americana-y songs. And this is quite different. Could you tell us about that song and where the tone and sound of that came from?
I mean, the tone and sound came from Daniel, because he wrote that song for his band. And it was going to be the lead single on their next record, which is coming out soon, and it will be on that record. But when I heard it, I mean, to borrow the title of the song, I got overwhelmed, and I couldn't stop listening to it. And it just had this tone to it, this desperate quality, this very bittersweet, sentimental desperation that felt the way I wanted this movie to feel. It also had a pop sensibility to it that I was really excited by. I wanted this movie to embrace the play, to be playful in that way, to have a sort of pop quality to it. And so I wrote the song into the script, and then asked Daniel if he minded if I used it. And thankfully he said yes. And it really became like the centerpiece of the film in many ways. You know, that song literally occurs about halfway into the movie is when we first hear it, but it really became, you know, the emotional, you know, focal point for both Casey and Rooney, and for, I think, for the audience as well.
And you mentioned Rooney there, so I imagine you've been asked a lot about the pie scene, in which Rooney eats a whole pie during one unbroken take before exiting to another room. It's extraordinary. She's extraordinary in it. But I wanted to ask you who's pulling focus at the end of the scene, because they must have nerves of steel.
Justin Scheidt, our first assistant camera, was pulling focus there. And what can I say? He nailed it. He just nailed it. We didn't, you know, he knew to follow her to the bathroom when she ran off off screen, and we didn't talk about it. He just did it, and it was perfect. I mean, he's a great AC, so.
Yep. I mean, I don't think I could handle that, watching someone, you know, you can only do one take at this, and you can only get one shot, and just nailing it like that. And what was the mood like on set during that scene? Have everyone just kind of witnessing that? Do you imagine you feel like this is special to be part of this?
It did feel special, but it also, you know, we approached it very pragmatically. We everybody kind of knew that this was a very important scene, and we didn't fuss over it too much. We just, everybody did their jobs, and like, as with that focus pool, we didn't really think about it too much. We just knew what had to be done, and we did it. And I remember it being very quiet and peaceful that day on set, and everyone was focused on their one little task. You know, the sound guy had to plant the mic in the right place, and we had to put the camera in the right place. The lights had to do a certain thing, and Justin had to pull focus the right way. It was all very mechanical. And I think, you know, because we were focusing so much on just, you know, our own, my job as a director, Andrew's job as a cinematographer, Justin's job as an AC, and then Rooney focused on her job as the actress in the scene, we all just, you know, brought our best to that moment and didn't overstep our bounds. That we didn't overthink things, we didn't fuss over it, and as a result, it was a very, you know, simple scene to achieve, but we knew that there was a lot of weight on it. You know, we knew that it was an important scene, that we had to get it right, but we didn't overthink. We didn't stress about that.
And lastly, news recently broke about Strange Angel, which sounds interesting to say the least. For those listeners who don't know about Jack Parsons and his story, could you give us a brief synopsis and how you might be involved in that project?
This is a television pilot that crossed my desk just a few weeks ago, and I've done a little bit of TV in the past. I've directed two things for television, and I really enjoyed those experiences. So I was always open to doing more. And when I read this script, I couldn't believe that it hadn't already been made into a movie. It's a true story about one of the founders of JPL, one of the fathers of modern rocket science, who also was a member of Aleister Crowley's occult sex rituals in Hollywood back in the 30s and 40s. The story goes much deeper than that. It is really insane. I look forward to being a small part of its realization on screens everywhere next year. But it's just one of those stories you have to look up and read about, because it is just too crazy to be true, and yet it is true.
Excellent. David Lowry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So the first thing I asked myself after leaving this film was, have I seen anything like that before? And the only answer I could come up with was no. What were your guys' first thoughts immediately after watching this film?
Well, I think it's a film of... It feels very original in terms of the story. When we talk about the vibe and the tone of the film, I think there are some parallels we can draw between David Gordon Green's work, his early work in particular, and Terrence Malick is someone who keeps coming up. It has quite a lofty quality to it that is reminiscent of Malick's work, although I think that A Ghost Story and David Lowry is a bit more humble than Malick, who projects a certain wisdom, whereas Lowry seems like he's exploring ideas. He's not quite sure what the truth is, but he's willing to put his neck on the line and say what he thinks might be going on in the world.
Yeah, that's funny, because our job basically entails finding films that are similar to the film that we're discussing, and thinking about how they performed and how we're going to talk about them for our audiences. So we always have to do this kind of little comparative analysis, which films were you reminded of? And for me, again, yes, it was very much David Gordon Green and Terrence Malick, but also my two kind of references for this were Personal Shopper, which was obviously another ghost story,
definitely.
Although very, very different in its treatment of ghosts and also in its genre, or genres, so shall we say, because Personal Shopper is really kind of going in lots of different directions. And who knows what the genre of a ghost story is. And also for me, there was kind of a reminiscence somewhere, although these are two widely different titles, but Upstream Color is a title that came to mind, you know, the work of Shane Carruth.
Definitely.
And this kind of sort of different idea about the weird and how to represent the weird, but also a very much a kind of Sundance-y indie aesthetic that runs through a ghost story.
And he, David Lowery actually edited Upstream Color.
Yes.
So there's definitely a connection there.
Definitely.
A stylistic crossover. There are certain parts of it that slightly reminded me in a really bizarre way of Beetlejuice. In that it's
Beetlejuice.
Like, because it's kind of...
Yes.
Yeah.
Haunted House.
It is kind of Haunted House, but a different look at a Haunted House, like from the other side. So from the point of view of the ghost. And this whole thing of the bedsheet is used in Beetlejuice quite a lot as well. And I mean, this what this film does really brilliantly is use that iconic image that we're so familiar with, and is almost a comedic figure now, the ghost of two eyeholes, and uses that to create something with actual meaning and sadness and grief. And I think that's something that is at the heart of any ghost narrative, this idea of something that can't let go, something that's lost, and something that needs to find some sort of meaning in order to move on. Did you find that in the film, these kind of themes? And how do they sort of present themselves to you?
Absolutely. I think what you're talking about moving on, about letting go of things, finding peace with your situation, I think is ultimately what it's about. It's about, the tagline is, it's all about time, I think. And it's kind of, it's about patience, it's about being able to grieve and deal with heartache and loneliness. And I'm sure everybody has, you know, you've been dumped, or you've been the dumper, or you've lost someone under tragic circumstances. You can't engineer or rush a recovery.
Yeah.
It happens when it happens. And then maybe there's a moment when suddenly you get that release. And you didn't even see it coming, you just realise you're okay now. And I think that the arc of the story is building towards that.
Sure.
Don't want to go into spoiler territory, but...
Yeah, what's unusual, though, is how much a ghost story is really about the ghost. Because usually all of this stuff affects the living. And there are so many films that kind of look at the process of grieving from the point of view of the living. Personal Shopper being one of them, which is very much looking at the iteration of grief as a kind of psychological disturbance, almost, that kind of appears as a paranormal effect. Whereas here, you are empathizing completely with this character who has no facial expression, doesn't talk, so we are in a way spared the Casey Affleck whiny voice, much as we like that whiny voice in certain films, such as The Assassination of Jesse James, which we are both huge fans. But it's a story that's told from the point of view of a character who's not emoting or expressing anything, and yet is incredibly expressive, thanks to a combination of the framing, the pacing of the storytelling, just this kind of oddbeat choices about camera angles and how the movement of this ghost is so just striking and unusual.
I completely agree, especially what you're saying about how expressive it is, and how a lot of the time we talk about performances and we say things like it's in the eyes. And we think about recently Dunkirk with Tom Hardy, and all we really see is his eyes. Whereas in the ghost story, you're just looking at two hollow black spaces. But onto that, you're able to project so many emotions because of the way they frame things, like you say, the way things are paced, the expressive movements that they give to the ghost and that she brings.
For me, there was also something about the blankness of the sheet. You know, you have this kind of comedy moment when he gets up for the first time, if we're allowed spoilers,
yeah.
And you think, what? And then it becomes completely acceptable, and you sort of really do project something onto this blank sheet, and it's very much like the process of watching cinema. You're watching things projected into a blank sheet and a blank canvas.
That's very
and you're
nice.
Really just going to buy into this concept and follow it. And for me, that also connected with the idea of the empty house, which is something that, for some reason, I personally find really moving. I really love going into empty houses, abandoned houses, all these kinds of, you know, slightly creepy places, looking for whatever is left of the people who were there before. And I think this film absolutely nails this kind of desire to haunt a place, or desire to discover what it is that is there when there's nothing there. So to me, it was just incredibly moving and really powerful. And I should also say that I saw this film about 3 months ago, and I haven't rewatched it since. And I have to absolutely confess that there hasn't been a day that I haven't thought about it. I woke up in the middle of the night after watching it, thinking, absolutely convinced that there was somebody watching me as I was asleep. And I can't tell you, you know, getting up to go to the loo in the middle of the night has become a whole new experience. And it's slightly terrifying, but slightly comforting in a way.
Because it's
for the most part, it's a non-threatening entity,
isn't
absolutely.
It? Yeah, definitely. It's not a ghost you're particularly scared of. It's kind of almost a nice thought that these people are still around. And
I mean, we
throw up a few films there which use ghosts in them, and they're often used as figures of horror, ways to create fear. But I think ghosts can equally be ways to create comfort.
Yeah.
And this kind of does that as well. And you mentioned there the whole thing of the empty house, and at times it felt like he was more connected to the house than he was to Rooney Mara's character.
Yeah.
In a way. Because when she leaves, he doesn't leave, he stays. He thinks there's something in this house that I'm connected to, not necessarily the person.
She's left a message in the house, hasn't she?
Yeah.
To me, that's really important. This notion that she did this, she says this, that as a child she did this in every house that she lived in. She left a secret message to be uncovered. And he knows where the message is, and he's trying to recover it. And are we allowed spoilers? Are we allowed to say what happens? Because, if that message is recovered, what happens? Is the key. So that's really important to me in terms of how is he attached to the house, is he attached to the person, or is he attached to some dream or something that this house meant for them, and this the relationship that he has with the house, where, you know, she asks him, you know, she wants to move, she wants to move out, there's something weird about it, it's falling apart, this house, and as any woman knows, you need to get out of it before it's a lot of work to tidy it up. And so they have this conversation the night before he dies. Shall we move? Shall we not move? And he says, no, there's something about this house. I want to stay here. There's something here.
The history. Yeah.
The history. So to me, the house is not just the physical house. It's really a home and what that embodies for them as a couple and for him as a person. There's clearly something that resonates.
Yeah,
which in a weird way, I'm not going to go on a digression, reminded me of a conversation we had about Howard's End recently, which was, so in Howard's End, there's a whole story. Howard's End is a house, a country house that's passed on from one person to another, but for some reason, something happens that prevents this straightforward inheritance from happening, except these two people between whom the transaction really happens pass a story from one to the other. And no one else knows about this story. And it's a story about magical things and sort of pig's teeth being embedded into a tree in the garden of the house. For more about this, check out our interview with Samuel West, in which we talked at length about it. But it's really the stories that connect the people who live in houses and the idea of what you leave behind there and what other people may have left behind that suddenly resonates with you that makes that house not empty at all for me. So that attachment is more than just, I quite fancy this bedroom and the curtains. And
David Lowery did a Q&A at the end of the screening that I saw, and he said in this film, no one owns anything. People, some of the characters assume ownership, But The House is an example of that, where Casey stays there, he feels it is his home, but other people intrude on it. And ultimately he has no say in whether it survives beyond the runtime of the film. Equally, the same thing is true of Rooney, Mara's character. He feels a bond with her, but she has to leave him, she has to move on, and it's about feeling ownership over these things in our life that we don't actually have any kind of bond or anything that can't be broken.
And that's where I saw the connection with the aspect ratio, actually.
Right.
That he's kind of... So the film, we should say, has this bizarre aspect ratio where it's very...
It's sort of Academy ratio, because okay. It has these rounded corners.
Yeah.
It's a little bit...
There's a square with rounded corners, essentially, right?
What's that Instagram filter called? Is it called bird, something bird? that's what it reminded me of. I have a friend who is completely obsessed with just taking Instagram pictures with this frame. So I have it very clear in my mind.
Jake's going to be talking to Charlie Lyne about this in more detail later on. But for me, it was about boxing someone in and about someone's space being pushed towards their body. And so the ghost feels like he has to be boxed in. He has to be connected to this. Like a house is essentially a box. You know, he feels like he has to stay within the confines of this box, and he's connected to this box. That's what I thought the aspect ratio was there for.
Mm. So what happens when the box is removed? Aha.
That's just how I interpreted it. How did you guys interpret the meaning behind the aspect ratio? Like, what do you think it meant?
Well, we were asking ourselves this question, and we've discussed it quite a few times. And for me, it was mostly an aesthetic, sort of filmmaking aesthetic choice. And bizarrely, even though the Academy ratio has this long hallowed history and was essentially the standard ratio for shooting films before widescreen took over, which is now the standard, the kind of elongated rectangle. The film doesn't really harken back to Academy ratio films. It doesn't do the job that Meek's Cut Off, for example, does, which is a recent example of a film shot in Academy ratio, which is a Western that's really trying to go back to the Western genre and disrupt it in a very significant way, but from within its visual limitations. To me, it's the Instagram thing, although it sounds really daft, there is some significance in there. There is, you know, if you think about it, Instagram is kind of a way to photograph something that's very present, and it's a very contemporary aesthetic, which applies this filter of old to photographs to give them this kind of depth of historical profundity and meaning, which can be extremely synthetic and artificial. But at the same time, I think it's really trying to do the job of the film to say something quite complex about timelessness and about the passing of time and how that connects with nostalgia. Now, all of these are very, very big words, and I don't have, I'm afraid, a unifying theory of why I think this film is shot in this ratio. But that's kind of the space where I found myself thinking that there's something, for example, the film doesn't really rely on contemporary technology to tell the story. It's very difficult to tell what time period it's actually set in, because as we were saying, there are characters who look like they're from the 70s, and yet go to Shoreditch these days and you'll see people who look like they've been shipped in from a time traveling spacecraft. So it feels very contemporary, and in that contemporary aspiration to try and make a kind of timeless cinema, to try and dislodge something from the specifics of a time period. So, yeah, there you go. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think it is ultimately an aesthetic choice. I think the film feels thoroughly contemporary. It feels like it is made in the year that it is made, the way that it observes life. But everyone who lives in it and exists either looks like they're from another time, or the house is it's a lo-fi life, we were saying. Mm. There doesn't feel like there's much technology in the house. It's a suburban property in Texas. It doesn't have the backdrop of a metropolis anywhere. So it feels completely timeless. And it is this, maybe it's this hearkening back for a simpler way of life that all these nostalgic filters on Instagram try and capture, when really it's all just a lot of contemporary sound. But then the music in the piece is quite modern. It's very disruptive and electronic and quite abrasive in places, although it becomes very tender during the lyrics. But
very Bon Iver.
I think nostalgia is a good word to put on this film. And yeah, particularly in relation to this idea of being attached to a house. Did you guys see 99 Homes? With Michael Shannon.
Yes.
There's a quote, and Michael Shannon. Garfield, here's a quote. So I'm like, don't get attached to houses, they're just boxes.
Yeah.
Very good. As well.
But they're not. Yeah. They're not. They're boxes with stories in them. they're not. And I think this is a very contemporary and very kind of capitalist way of looking at houses. And of course, 99 Homes is a film that really takes capitalism to town.
Absolutely.
And really tears it apart.
Yeah.
It's, you know, houses in this film and in so many films are just so much more than the kind of the property ladder, the thing that you sell to get a bigger one. And that's something that makes it particularly affecting, I think.
So, yeah, as I mentioned in the introduction there, a lot of people are talking about this pie scene.
Yes.
What did you guys make of that? Because I've actually found it quite really difficult to watch. And especially the sound, quite excruciating.
Did you the same fork effect? On glass.
The fork on glass and sort of the...
munching.
The swallowing.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of that. Sorry if you're listening. I did that.
Let us not use the words gag reflex. Yeah. This is the Curzon podcast, after all.
And it goes on for so long. And it's just difficult to watch. What did you guys think?
Is it really a chocolate pie?
It's a chocolate pie, yeah.
It's a vegan chocolate pie. Yeah. I thought it was a pumpkin pie, which we even more like ick inducing. Yeah. Imagine eating a whole pumpkin pie, and I love pumpkin pie.
Yeah.
But
With no cream.
Yeah.
Not a fan of cream. I leave a cream. I love a slice of pumpkin pie. I was convinced it was pumpkin pie because of the kind of Halloween-y references. It felt to me very true to life. I have had moments in my life where if you don't want to think about anything, you just kind of stuff your face, which is not a very healthy thing to encourage. Please, kids at home, do not do this. It's very bad for you. But it just, I think it's meant to be excruciating to watch. It's meant to be one of those moments where you're also made to think, has she actually fed herself for the past few days? I've had very little experience of funerals and death in my life, but when my grandfather died in southern Italy, there's kind of a rule, you're not allowed to cook in the house of the deceased. So everyone brings you food, literally everyone in town. So on the day of his funeral, we had more food than the 100 people who were there could possibly eat, and we just had to keep eating. And it's kind of a weird... response mechanism, because you're feeding yourself for survival, and yet you're having to get through all this stuff. You cannot reject it, you can't say, oh, you know, this is no thank you. So there's something in there about the process of grief and how horrible it actually is from a physical point of view, how you're going to sustain yourself and how you're going to force yourself through stuff even though you don't want to do it. And once you're halfway through it, you just have to continue. So there's kind of there's something in that endurance and in that length of time watching it. And bless poor Rooney Mara, the things you have to do for acting.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I think the experience of watching it is quite, it's a bit excruciating for various reasons. I think when it initially starts, you see an emotion straight away and you can start to recognize what's happening, and then it goes on a bit longer than you feel like it should have cut at one point, and then it goes on more, and then it continues going, and you suddenly become aware of the technique of this whole scene and the conceit of the scene, and you start to think about, oh wow, he hasn't cut, and it almost took me out of the scene, out of the film.
Mm.
And it reminds me of what Stuart Lee does when he does his repetitions at Ad Absurdia, and he's, you know, Del Boy falls through the bar over and over and over again. And you go through this range of emotions where you almost go through stages of grief where you start to get a bit annoyed that you're still watching this, and then you accept you're still watching it and question why you are and reflect on why you are. And what's brilliant about that whole sequence for me is that at the end of when it comes to its head, you get shocked out of the repetition of the eating. Without a cut, it's just within the scene, things, something happens that immediately pulls you back to the emotion, because it's a very dramatic moment, and you immediately come back to where you started, which was this is a depiction of intense grief. But within that, you've gone through a lot of questions about the filmmaking. You've had time to contemplate the scene.
I always feel
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Very ambivalent when you can observe the filmmaking so clearly. That there's something about the tyranny of the long take, you know, knowing that you're going to subject someone to a fixed camera thing for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I utterly love it as a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, who is a master of the long take. And there's a lot of long takes in this film.
Yeah.
But to me, it really also connected to this idea of both the frame and what are you looking at when you're looking at something that is a kind of fixed frame. And there's real mastery in focusing where the viewer's attention goes and making sure that there's something going on in every corner of that frame, even when it seems that there's very little going on, because there's very subtle work happening with lighting. I can think of, you know, a lot of kind of fixed camera shots, or for example the which is not a fixed camera shot, but the reveal of the accident is absolutely stunning, and very arresting and unusual. You know, I've never seen a film that kind of pulls back from the shocking moment and gives you another one in a completely different way. So it's quite a difficult experience to sit and watch a filmmaker work, as well as watching what the narrative of the film is trying to do. But that to me is a moment where I get really excited, that moment where I'm kind of working through it and really trying to figure out, what am I looking at? How is it made? Why is it made like this? And what is it telling me?
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful when all of these things sublimate together in the same scene.
Which it exactly does in this scene. The scene really pays off when it goes full circle back to those original emotions. I think it's a very, very good scene, but quite an experience to sit through.
Absolutely, And there's another part of the film as well which does something really interesting with sound, and that's, you mentioned earlier that she's hidden a note in this wall.
Yeah.
The scratching of his, like, fingers through the cloth, getting the note out. I found that, for some reason, it just really sort of scraped into my ear.
Yeah.
When I was watching it.
That's a lot like Upstream Colour. Do you remember that kind of sound that runs through Upstream Colour, which is very distressing? And the scratchy.
Yeah.
It's. Do you? I live in an old Victorian house, and there's always these little noises, and you think, who? What is making this? There's this kind of, you know, repeated things that keep happening, and you can't quite work out.
It's such a quiet film in general that any sound like that just becomes immediately pronounced. And there are long passages where you feel like you're plunged into silence. There might be some atmospheric murmurings, but it's a very quiet, largely dialogue-free film. And those sounds, like you say, really stand out.
They also really embody the ghost in that it's not just an ethereal presence which you could figure out, you know, is someone's projection or something. No, it's absolutely real. It's completely real, and you can hear it and you can see it. The fact that you continue to see it, and not many characters are able to see him. So we talked about this earlier. There's the sequence with the little boy and girl, and the little boy can absolutely see a ghost. He knows. He knows there's someone there. He knows it's being looked at. He can feel it. And it's quite an interesting sequence that I don't know if you wanted to go into it, talking about how at that point is the point where Casey Affleck's character goes by the name of C, or just Ghost, turns into one of those, you know, properly
poltergeist.
Folktale haunting poltergeist ghost goes absolutely berserk, smashes things up, and clearly does it because he wants to get rid of these people. Yeah. There's something that really grates with him. But that relationship with the little boy was a really revelatory moment for me, because it really told me this is real. It's absolutely true.
I think on one hand you can see the ghost as, like, you know, metaphorical and allegorical for many things we've been talking about, but ultimately there is a ghost in this film, which is kind of nice to see that it goes for this theme with sincerity, without irony. It's about life as a ghost. It's a ghost story. It's not kind of, you know, attaching it to anything it's not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's really nice to see. So what did you guys think about some of the other characters, some of the other sequences we've seen? Because we've stayed in the house for quite a while. What did you think of the kind of the hipster party?
Well,
and that one, that big moment, that really long speech, that long stretch of dialogue with this guy called
monologue.
He's credited as the prognosticator.
Yes.
What did you guys think of that? Because I can't quite decide how I felt about that moment.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that monologue as well. I think at the time of watching it, I found it a little bit grating, a little bit pretentious. However, the job what it's doing narratively in allowing us to comprehend what comes after it, and again, as I mentioned at the start, I think Lowry comes from a humble position where he's throwing ideas out. He's not trying to claim that he knows what life is all about. He's just he's got an idea about what maybe it is, and he has a sense of humour about it. So I don't think we're to take the prognosticator entirely seriously. I think we're supposed to find him a bit of a bore. But the way that he is almost prophesizing what's going to come next, it works within the film, and ultimately it pays off.
Right.
I think.
He's kind of a character that you've met at every party you've ever been to, and it tends to be a man, I'm afraid. So, mansplainer extraordinaire could be his subtitle. But I know that there's certainly, you know, in thinking back to the film, a great element of dislike of this character or irony. And yet, I know that while I was watching it the first time, by this stage, I was so happy and prepared to believe whatever this film was going to throw at me, that I took it entirely seriously, like just straightforward. Yeah, man, this is so true. It's like, oh my god, that's awesome. How did you come up with that? Mozart. Whoa, you know about Mozart. But there is a key idea in this speech, which is the idea of legacy and what you leave behind and what remains of you after you've gone, which does tie into all the kind of cosmological crazy stuff that happens afterwards. And to me, it's really important that it's there, and it's really important that it's expressed in this kind of you know, speech vomit kind of here. I'm just gonna say it, because otherwise no one else really speaks in the film. So I like that moment. I very much liked it. And I like that kind of, I don't like this guy, and yet there is something in what he's saying that I'm just going to believe. Plus, I really like his music, can I say?
Yeah, sure.
I'm kind of well disposed to him.
He wrote some music for Pete's Dragon, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that's his connection.
And his band is very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it felt slightly like someone telling me instead of showing me at times. And I felt like the film shows you so much so well that maybe it didn't need that. But like you say, maybe it did. Maybe we just needed that little bit of clarity there. Also at that party is Kesha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't I clock her.
I don't remember.
I'll be honest, I had to look that up.
It's a ghost performance.
She's called Spirit Girls.
Yeah, and I thought that meant she was the ghost next door.
That's what I thought as well.
But that's David Lowery.
I thought that ghost was female. Some gender stereotype in there, but...
Because of the floral sheet.
Possibly.
Okay, so before we move on to our second interview, do you guys have any final thoughts on A Ghost Story?
I think it's a terrific film. It really stays with you for a very, very long time, and it's very cheesy to use the word haunting, but it really does have a very profound effect on you if you're happy to buy into it. And I think everyone should see it, and it's great, and I can't wait to see it again.
I agree. I think while it is quite a melancholic film and there are characters that have a fierce cynicism to them, ultimately you end up with a very optimistic finale, and it stays with you as a very positive film.
Life affirming.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hopeful ending in a way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I really, really liked this film a lot, and like I said at the beginning, I can't think I've ever seen anything quite like it, and as you said, it stays with you for a long time. So there we go. But as promised, we do have a second interview for you this week. So Charlie Lyne is a British film critic and filmmaker, perhaps most well known for his documentaries Beyond Clueless and Fear Itself. One of his most recent shorts, Fish Story, is available on The Guardian's website. And he's just released a new film about aspect ratios titled Frames and Containers. So who better to discuss A Ghost Story's unusual choice of aspect ratio than Charlie Lyne? So without further ado, here is Jake Cunningham talking to Charlie Lyne himself.
So we're delighted to welcome Charlie Lyne onto the Curzon podcast this week, and in a kind of link a bit to A Ghost Story.
Sure.
Thank
you for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on. So it's no coincidence that Charlie's with us for this episode for A Ghost Story, because Ghost Story is presented in an, I would say unusual, but maybe unusual for 2017 aspect ratio, and Charlie has just released a short about aspect ratios.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about
Very
frames?
Cool.
Yeah.
Can I a bit about my short?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, it's like a 9-minute video essay, and as you say, it's about aspect ratios, but specifically about the use of different aspect ratios, different frame shapes, to convey different emotional ideas or narrative ideas, or really just to like aid in cinema's many endeavors. And it's also about how one of the real hindrances to that has always been like the fixed shape of the cinema screen. So while you can make all kinds of wonderfully different frame shapes, you still have this sort of firm box in which to play in. And so the film is about that, and it's about how we might move past that.
Like with A Ghost Story in Dunkirk, people are talking about the way films are being presented. And people might think, listening to this, that this is maybe what your film is about. But this goes back 100 years when it's still an issue then.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the inspiration for the video is an essay called The Dynamic Square that Sergei Eisenstein wrote in 1931, but could have been written today. Mm. Like, he is essentially arguing for the ability of cinema to have all kinds of different frame shapes, but what he specifically wants is a tall image, which obviously now he would have in a million smartphone videos. And, you know, he would be on, the right side of history advocating for that as an exciting new form, rather than the people who go like, turn it round, turn it round, do it landscape. This is like a very old problem and dilemma. And in fact, I think one that people were almost more willing to address at that point when cinema was in its infancy than they are now, when we've got used to the idea that like wide images mean prestige and mean like a respectable form of cinema. And if anything, like you're right that stuff like, especially something like Dunkirk, which obviously Christopher Nolan is one of the proponents of, like, the, you know, worship form of cinema going, where you have to see it in a certain way and you have to see it with other people and you have to do this and you have to do that. And yet even that, you know, in seeking to use the IMAX format with its incredible resolution and all this stuff, he has found himself using a, you know, kind of squatter frame, almost, I think it is almost 4:3, yeah. isn't it? Maybe it is literally. So I think that even, you know, in its own way, that that kind of helpfully illustrates that, you know, prestigious filmmaking doesn't just mean wide, wide, wide.
Yeah. So when you started, or when you kind of showed this film, you said it's for nerds. But I think when you watch it, nerd or not, it is just, it's kind of making people think about the way that their media is being presented to them as well, and the shapes that that come in.
Yeah, I think like one of the most gratifying things having it online has been the few people who've replied to me and said, like, I am actively disinterested in aspect ratios, but you made me care for 9 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's amazing, and that's very nice to hear. I think what hopefully people will take from the film as well is that, like, you can, as I do, obsess over these things and learn the minutiae of every little technical detail of the various film formats and aspect ratios and so on. But the point is actually how they inform your viewing experience and how they allow us to have like a flexible, fluid relationship with cinema in all kinds of different spaces and on all kinds of different screens. And I think that's the bit that that is applicable to, you know, everyone's lives who has any kind of relationship with movies, rather than, you know, like a pedantic knowledge of exactly how they work. So hopefully, yeah, it gets people thinking about the way they watch films and how they interact with them, and also hopefully stands as a bit of a rebuke to the idea that there is like a right and a wrong way. I think that is going to become increasingly futile acclaim, especially, you know, when the right way becomes, you know, the kind of 15 perforation 70 millimeter vaunted IMAX experience that Christopher Nolan might advocate, which is really wonderful if, like me, you live in London and can go to the IMAX and can afford the £17.50 ticket price. Not so great if your nearest IMAX is a 5-hour drive away.
Yeah.
So I think hopefully, yeah, it gets across that there's more to cinema than the cinema.
Yeah, I think that's some of the achievement in A Ghost Story, is that Larry has very much presented it as a cinema film, and it's all about getting people to watch it in the cinema. But I don't think, compared to maybe Dunkirk or other Nolan films, I don't think A Ghost Story will be any lesser for being watched at home.
No, in fact, the thing it most strongly reminded me of is, because like, I found the film very affecting and very moving, but it's like deeply intimate, quite like introspective film, and it reminded me of some of the most like powerful film viewing experiences I've had at home. When you are in that kind of vulnerable, familiar space, and something like that is quite meditative and quite kind of provocative can really tap into a certain headspace, which I think is almost easier to reach at home. I kind of imagined watching it on a laptop in bed. And I think like there's a lot to be said for that kind of film viewing, as well as the collective cinema going experience, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I think this is a movie that could have quite a lot of lives, unlike you say Dunkirk, which perhaps you want the kind of screamingly loud collective experience.
And you mentioned on Twitter a few films that maybe some purists would be angry at you for having watched on your phone or on your iPad. This is coming from a guy that yesterday watched 8.5 on a train.
Great. It must have been a long train journey. Yeah, no, I can't remember what this was. I think this was some Twitter argument about...
probably post-Dunkirk.
About whether you're allowed to watch a film. I haven't seen Dunkirk yet, in fact, but I will be watching that on the big screen. Because, you know, you can't torrent it yet. I would think I was saying, listing like great first viewings I'd had on my phone, of which there are many.
Yeah, and so do you think that like people are maybe a bit too protective over it, and that it's more, film should more be accessible regardless of the form that it's being presented in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not, like, the last thing I would say is that there's no difference. I think there's a vast difference between watching a film in a dark room with 100 other people or watching a film in the palm of your hand or so on. There's huge differences. What I don't think there is like a hierarchy where one is innately better than another. Like, they offer all kinds of different experiences and are often enhanced or not by being placed kind of like within the context of your daily life.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about going in a cinema that can kind of separate off film from our actual lived experience, which to me can feel wrong depending on what the film in question is. Maybe that's what you want. If you want to just be like lifted out of your own existence and dropped onto a beach during the war, maybe that's not what you want if you're watching a kind of meditative drama about death.
Yeah.
So I think it's, there's still obviously like drawbacks to watching a film on your phone. It's a bit annoying if you have to hold it the whole time. The screen is quite small unless you've got one of those really big phones. There's the sound issue. You know, it's not ideal, but nor is it out of the question.
Yeah.
How was 8.5?
I felt wrong when I had to pause it. It just felt a bit off. And there's a few moments where I felt people watching me. But then I had this experience when I did a rewatch of Twin Peaks, and I did when I was watching the first episode of series one, where Leland Palmer just breaks down and it's just screaming. And I was watching that on the train and I felt so awkward and I felt like everyone was watching me.
Right.
But I didn't. And I actually thought, I know David Lynch has said that he's very anti anyone watching anything on their phone or things like that. And I was watching it on a computer.
I'd be interested to know though whether he stands by that, because that was a long, like, people still drag that video up, but that was like 15 years ago now.
Mm.
And it was very much in the early days of it even being possible to watch film on your phone. So I think in fairness, you would have been talking like 360p,
yeah,
maxing out on a phone. But also he's become such a huge proponent of like new technologies and new ways of filmmaking in the last decade that I just can't quite believe he still would want the theatrical experience, especially now, you know, obviously.
Well, with the new series, so many people would be accessing it not on their TV.
Right.
Right.
Although I know that he is still very precious about everything, about it being broadcast weekly.
Right.
So maybe he has his traditional blind spots. But yeah, I think also the thing that's undeniably true is so much of this, and hopefully this is in the film, the short, so much of this is just about like tradition and what we accept as the right way and what we write off as the wrong way. It's like all the people who would berate you for watching a film on your phone probably wouldn't berate you for watching a film on a plane, even though you're much likely to have like a better screen on your phone than on the back of your plane seat. But because we've been doing that for decades, that's just a accepted mode of viewing at this point. Even if there are cliches about like watching crap films on a plane or whatever, like that's just entered the like pantheon of ways that we watch movies. And I think inevitably devices will join that list very soon.
You kind of, we briefly touched on it earlier, and you kind of end Frames and Containers by talking about the possibilities of VR, which I'd never done. And so preemptive to this interview, I went and tried it out for the first time.
Oh, what did you do?
The Science Museum, they have a space jump from when Tim Peake left the space station and came back down to Earth. They've done a recreation of that.
Wow.
And so that was quite an odd experience for me, because I kind of just, I sat down and I put the things on. And because I'm so used to any screen experience just being, you sit down and look at what's in front of you. I didn't move for about 2 minutes and was just looking forwards. And then I had an itch on my shoulder and I moved my head to, and then I noticed that the screen came with me. When I looked to the side, suddenly there was more. Then I start looking and swirling my head around and kind of had realized why this was maybe a big thing. Do you think it will be? Or do you think it could be a 3D?
I think, I mean, people still make movies in 3D, don't they?
Yeah.
Are big movies still in 3D? I don't really know.
They are, but it is statistically less are being made.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think certainly, like, supply is outstripping demand for now, and there's a huge amount of investment going into something that no one really outside of, like, an incredibly small audience of techie people are using. But I can't see it not being adopted, at least in some quarters. I think what seems to be the disagreement is, like, over what's going to be the prevalent form of it. So, like, is it going to be 360 video, like it sounds like you were watching, where presumably you couldn't have any, like, control?
No, it was just sat down
in that universe. Or, as a lot of people I know are pushing much more towards, it's like everything is going to be interactive, so it's much more about, like, you know, your agency over the narrative as it unfolds. That appeals less to me. I don't know why. Maybe I'm stuck in my ways. The kind of version that I talk about in the film is more the idea that it's freeing us entirely from the idea of, like, a screen shape or any kind of constraint. So I think it's very freeing in that sense. And, you know, certainly I can imagine, like, something as simple as putting on a VR headset and watching a ghost story just sort of, like, floating in front of you in its little postcard frame. Yep. Being an incredibly satisfying way to do that.
Yeah. Oh, that would be great.
Wouldn't even need to leave the comfort of your home.
Yeah. Oh, not that I'm an expert in VR, but that sounds brilliant.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think that's where, like, the big VR money is going. It's just, like, making, like, quite a nice little viewing experience for indie films, but certainly that's always going to be there.
Yeah. And we've talked a bit about the internet, and it's been key in helping people, myself included, watch a lot of films that we wouldn't normally have access to, and watching them on various devices. And I would think with your work, particularly starting with Beyond Clueless, access to the internet has been pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. So Beyond Clueless, if people aren't familiar with it, is a essay film about teen movies. It's an hour and a half long, and it's built entirely from existing teen movies kind of collaged together to kind of deconstruct and analyze that genre. Absolutely the driving force behind that was this, what even, you know, only a few years ago in, like, 2014 when that movie came out, still felt like quite a bracing new mode of film viewing, which is just the availability of everything at your fingertips and the ability to just leap between them. You know, I think, like, when did Netflix launch in the UK? It was only, like, 2011 or something, I think. But I remember that just being, like, such a revelation, the idea that film viewing didn't necessarily need to be, like, committing to an hour and a half and, like, and often, you know, committing a fiver to that hour and a half. Like, it could be flitting between experiences.
And Beyond Clueless is chaptered, so is part of that reasoning down that people could pause it.
Right. I mean, not consciously, but in hindsight, absolutely. Like, the whole thing was definitely inspired by that kind of, like, synaptic almost mode of viewing. And, you know, it emerged from watching 200-300 teen movies in quick succession. And the way that their boundaries all blurred and they all seem to start existing in this one shared teen movie universe. And so my idea was to create a film that would feel like it was based in that universe. I love the idea that people might, like, watch 30 minutes of it and go, like, oh yeah, do you remember that film? And then watch an hour of that film, like, and then go back to mine. I really don't care how people watch it, as long as they watch it engagedly. Like, when that then wound up on Netflix, and when you finished it, it would say, like, do you want to watch Mean Girls? That felt like a perfect continuation of that sort of mode of thinking.
And it kind of feels like there's this very kind of strong relationship between that film and the internet, because it was born, but it exists because of Kickstarter.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, I think I was lucky that was quite new here at the time. I think it was only in like the second month of Kickstarter's existence in the UK. And obviously that's a website that people quite quickly got quite sick of hearing about, or at least being asked to support. So again, yeah, like it was very fortunate that it seemed to kind of tap into a thing at the exact moment of its genesis. Also at the, you know, I don't know whether I was just like hyper aware because I was working on it at the time, but it seemed to be the moment that like kids who grew up with 90s teen movies suddenly were in charge of like commissioning for Saturday newspaper supplements and stuff, and so suddenly there are all these like articles about like, oh, the 90s teen revival and all this blah 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 blah, which I don't doubt helped the film, although I think it was purely a case of like all those people getting to an age when they start getting nostalgic, as was certainly the case with me. But yeah, no, things have a strange way of kind of like coming together.
Yeah, I think since then, in the last few years, we've seen an explosion of these essay films, whether that's short film or long form on the internet. People like Nerdwriter, Tony Show, Cognada, these films, they like, particularly thinking Cognada's work, it kind of exists in its own right rather than just being about the film that it's about. Do you find that pretty exciting that there's so much work is now available online of people delving into films?
Yeah, totally. I think like the thing that's really amazing to me is the way it's completely collapsed the distinction that would have been there previously between like films, quote unquote, and then I think how essay filmmaking was often thought of before as this like parasitic, almost like attachment that existed like as an extension of like quote unquote proper work. And like you say, like you watch something that Cognada has made that's maybe a 10-minute film about a film that you've never seen, and in and of itself it's such a fascinating piece of art, and it's so fully formed and it's so engaging that it's all the more interesting for being connected to another work of art, but it's by no means greater or lesser than inherently that work of art.
Like with Beyond Clueless, I have not seen...
No one could have. Yeah. That's the thing.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
And it's so... But it works. Completely works. And I'm not... Like, I'm... Yeah, it's so enjoyable, but that's not for necessarily getting it all.
And I think what's really nice is, like, I still have some of these, like, hang-ups, definitely, where, like, you know, frames and containers, the aspect ratio thing. It's like a 9-minute film. I put it on the internet. I have to like force myself to call it a film because I like, as someone who's been making this work for years now, have these like hang ups still of like, you know, this is a video and this is a film and this can play film festivals and this just goes on YouTube. And the, you know, like Cognada, who we were just talking about, has just made a fiction feature film with like, a, you know, an amazing cast, and it was at Sundance, and like it's absolutely not a video essay really in any way, unless you're thinking in very abstract terms, but the real challenge is to not think of it as any more or less of a film than everything he made before. And I very much, like, as a point of principle, believe that to be the case, but I still sometimes have to like push myself to actually go down that road.
I'm really excited about Columbus. Cognada's film is probably one of my most anticipated for the year, and I still haven't got word of when it's going to be out in the UK. But for the... He's kind of branched out there, and he's branched out from other people's work to tell his own story, which in a way, for the first time, we got really from you with Fish Story a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, it's like, well, it's not really my story.
No, that's true.
Is the thing, though. It, I'm still sort of cannibalizing. yeah, the film is a short documentary in which a friend of mine called Casper Salmon tells the story of his grandmother, Mrs. Salmon, supposedly being invited to this gathering in Wales in the 1980s, at which her and a bunch of other fish surnamed people were kind of congratulated on their names and given the fish of their name. And so the film is half him telling that story and then half me investigating.
Yeah, because I think you,
whether or not it's true.
At the start of the film, it's you getting him to tell the story again. So it sounds like you've heard this a lot of times.
Yeah, well, it was like he made the mistake of telling it me once and then I couldn't let it lie. Like if I ever introduced him to someone new, it would be like, this is Casper. Casper, tell the fish story. So this is really just a continuation of that. And yeah, you say it's different, but actually the more I think about it, it's like, it's basically just an essay film about his story, where rather than like taking an existing film and presenting it in a new context, I'm taking an existing story and completely taking it for myself.
Yeah, I think with this, what's interesting is what I would struggle with if I had done the work that you've previously done is then having to actually go and get the camera out and decide how things are going to look.
Why do people bother shooting new material? What a headache. I take no joy in it. It takes forever and it's utterly unsatisfying to me until I can like sit down with the footage and start manipulating it. I'm definitely not one for the shoot.
Going back to A Ghost Story, people can choose to watch this on a VR headset or an iPad. Being a cinema podcast, it's probably worth mentioning that it is also available to watch in the cinema too.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it at the cinema and I had a good time. I'm not writing that off as an option. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, it'd be interesting to certain people. It'd be interesting to me to see how it feels in different cinema spaces as well, because like the place I was at did the very proper thing of like bringing the curtains in. And that creates one kind of feel when you then have this like rounded image within that. But so many cinemas now don't do the curtain thing. It might almost be quite interesting to see what this looks like as kind of like an island within the screen. Or then you've got those cinemas that even have like curved screens, much like the frame of A Ghost Story. So then you've got a kind of a curve within a curve. If any of this is interesting to you, get in touch.
Yeah.
We might be friends. For the rest of you, apologies. The film was very good. You should go and see it.
Yeah, we should probably wrap up there then. once like everyone who, I mean, to be honest, probably 5 minutes in, most people stop listening.
Sure.
After the aspect ratio chat.
Yeah. It can happen.
Yeah. All right. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, so before we leave this week, we just want to quickly talk about The Handmaiden, which is now available on Curzon Home Cinema. And it became, I think it was one of the biggest foreign language releases in the UK of all time. Is that right?
Certainly the biggest of the last 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
Excellent news for foreign language cinema.
Absolutely.
Which doesn't exist, by the way. Cinema is a foreign language itself, in the words of Lewis Carroll.
It became one of my favourite films of the year. I first saw it at the London Film Festival last year, and I've since seen it two or three more times. Absolutely loved it. So I'm very happy it's now on Curzon Home Cinema. So, guys, what did you think of The Handmaiden?
It's a very long time ago since I saw it, but it's an absolutely delectable, very twisty thriller with lots of exciting and absolutely inventive stuff that happens in terms of the narrative twists and the plot turns. Some brilliant, brilliant female performances in it, and just really a fun ride. It's also got incredibly beautiful costumes, and the period setting is extraordinary. And a friend of mine explained to me some stuff about the particular choices of costume and cars. There's a lot of stuff to do with using up sort of Japanese cultural pieces within this setting in Korea, because this is all set at the time of the Japanese invasion of Korea, and this kind of cultural interdependence between the two, and how certain characters decide to pretend that they're going to assume this Japanese identity and others remain very much firmly in their Korean identity. So there's a lot to it that I'm not fully able to explain, but it's really one film that you want to dig into after you've enjoyed the kind of plot twist and turns. So I thoroughly recommend the second viewing, which is what I'm going to be doing probably tonight.
And it's also a really nice twist on the sort of revenge thriller as well.
Yeah.
Not just an older man going around shooting people that hurt his family. This actually has some intelligence to it. And actually, considering it's Park Chan-wook, who's known as this kind of really intensely violent director that's difficult to watch, I actually think this is quite, like we said about a ghost story, in a weird way, life-affirming and quite positive. In
yeah.
Way.
Yeah.
Quite hopeful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Girls to the front.
Yeah. So The Handmaiden was our film of the week a few months back on the podcast, so do check out our review for that and go and watch it on Curzon Home Cinema. So thank you very much for listening. If you like what you heard here, then why not go back and check out some of our archive episodes, including episodes on My Scientology Movie featuring Louis Theroux, Moonlight featuring the now Oscar-winning writer Tyrell Alvin McCraney, and Their Finest featuring Bill Nye and Gemma Arterton. So that's goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Ren.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me. Thank you very much for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.